Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
And I'm Matt Taibbi. How are you doing, Katie?
I'm okay, you?
In reality?
Yeah.
I'm kind of so, actually. I have kind of a headache. I'd say it's like an 8, maybe a 7. Whoa. Right now.
Yeah.
But I'm going to fight through it. That's, yeah. You know.
It's always fun when your co-host decides to go Christian Scientist on you.
You think I'm rejecting medicine? Is that what? Yeah. Right. So lots of stuff to talk about this week. I think we have good Democrats and Republicans suck this week. Unusually spicy. First of all, we have a great guest this week, but we've already told you who that person is.
Yeah, so. But in case you didn't watch our Monday morning.
Yeah. We know it's Oliver Stone.
It is Oliver Stone. Yep.
Yeah, who is somebody I have, I realized last night, I have many questions for, because his work has come up so often in my career, sort of indirectly, that is going to be interesting to talk to him. Like, for instance, a lot of the people I spent covering after the 2008 financial crisis were folks who mistakenly thought that Gordon Gekko was the hero of Wall Street. You know, so
right.
I'd be interested to talk. It's going to be fun to talk to him about some of that stuff, but has some other things he wants to discuss too. So we'll get to all that. But what do we have for Democrats suck this week?
I'll just say it's a little ridiculous that the pro-science, pro-vaccine party, the Democrats, aren't doing all that they can do to get other countries vaccinated.
Right.
And there's an article in These Times by Sarah Lazar, which shows that she got her hands on some documents from the latest WTO meeting. It turns out that they're not being as proactive as they could be. And she, in these documents that she got her hands on, the United States referred to the recent statement by President Biden in support of a waiver of intellectual property protections for COVID-19 vaccines, given the urgency of the pandemic and the recent developments of a new variant. Therefore, the U.S. said it will continue to engage with members to look for areas of convergence that can lead to a solution. But according to Sangeeta Shashikant, of the Third World Network, a global of research and advocacy organization based in Geneva, the US has not said much. What appears to me is at the political level, they're saying one thing, but the technical team, which refers to delegates who represent the US trade representative at the WTO, the technical team sees their role as facilitating discussions. There seems to be a disconnect between what the Biden administration may be saying and what may be playing out in reality. Not really pushing this waiver as much as they could. They're kind of supporting it in name, but they're not accepting the waiver that South Africa and India put forward.
Is this surprising? This is not.
Nah, I guess it's not surprising. It's incredible with the Omicron thing that there isn't more discussion about this, I think.
The lack of movement on the vaccine waiver is sort of the ultimately hypocritical political position, because they've not only pressed for mandates in this country, they've turned it into a sort of a culture war lodestar, right? Like, you must be vaccinated or else, you know, or else you're a bad person. I mean, we've had people suggesting now that you should be denied insurance coverage if you don't vax and stuff like that, right? Like, it's become a fixation on one side of the aisle. But if you're not actually committed to getting everybody vaccinated, because, well, except for in the instance of when it might prevent us from reaping massive profits or our donors from doing that.
Right.
You know, except for in that case, we don't really believe it. I mean, it just makes the whole thing triply infuriating. The irony, of course, is that probably this won't stoke a whole lot of outrage on the right. This whole idea of protecting profits and free enterprise, you're probably not going to get a ton of Republican legislators, let's just put it that way, going after the hypocrisy here.
Right.
Whereas to me, this undercuts all of the moral outrage about the vax mandates and everything else.
Right.
You don't really give a shit.
Right. I mean, and also it undercuts the idea that Dems are the party of science when don't they understand how this works? Like it doesn't respect nation state borders.
Right. Well, of course.
It's just so stupid. I don't even, I guess it's not surprising, but it's just infuriating. And I guess also the White House determined, so according to the Washington Post, the Biden administration has concluded that it lacks the authority to share details of Moderna's vaccine process.
Really?
Two senior administration officials told the Washington Post after a months-long legal review. This is by Dan Diamond, and it's at the Washington Post.
They could do whatever they wanted.
They could do whatever the hell they want, right?
And I mean, like, especially in an emergency, I mean, there's a million different things they could do. They could order the industrial production of this at any scale they wanted, and they could just at any price they wanted. But they'll hide behind the technicality. This is the parliamentarian version of
the
vaccine thing. So it's pathetic, and
it's really pathetic. And honestly, it makes me. Like, I don't believe in a lot of the anti-vax stuff, but it makes me see how, like, if you're an anti-vax person on the left, this does create, I kind of understand why, we'll probably have to cut this out so we don't get demonetized or suppressed on YouTube, but I understand why, like, if the government had really had people's best interests at heart, they would obviously do all they could do to get the patent waiver lifted or to get the vaccine produced.
Right.
For people even if they live in other countries. It's so stupid.
Yeah.
Is it just, it just really is. And then you sound like a conspiracy theorist, but it's true. They just really care more about big pharma donations than they do about saving people's lives, including the lives of Americans because of the way viruses work.
Well, it just, for me, it's the finger wagging, pandemic of the unvaccinated on the one hand, and then, oh, by the way, the rest of the world can go die of COVID and infect us, by the way,
because
we don't really care. We are basically, the hired flax of pharmaceutical companies, and who isn't going to become a total cynic at that point. And it's as you point out, it's hard not to be a conspiracy theorist at that moment, because then you start to see, well, all these draconian measures that are about surveillance and keeping track of who's vaccinated and who isn't, requiring new forms of identification, all these ideas that are in the works.
Identification.
If they don't really care about the actual goal of vaccinating people, then what's all that for? It's hard not to look at it. It's just a power grab. It's just an authoritarian thing. So I don't know. Pretty gross. That is perfectly representative of everything that I can't stand about the Democratic Party. And now, just to switch to Republican suck, we have a series of stories that kind of demonstrate everything I can't stand about the Republican Party. So this is it's sort of a perfect pair.
Yeah.
I don't know, Katie, did you hear the Lauren Boebert stuff?
Yeah, I did.
So we got to just look at her initial comedy routine, I'm kind of speechless at this. I'm in favor. I'm a person who is in favor of tasteless jokes generally.
But they should be funny.
They should be funny, and B, there's got to be a little bit of a discount for being a member of Congress. Like, you've got to have a little bit of sense about that. But anyway, let's look at her. This is obviously CNN's coverage of it, but let's look at
this guy, Mr. Free Speech, Mr. First Amendment.
Jim Acosta. Oh, my God. I
couldn't care less about Assange and won't even pretend to.
This guy is... This is embarrassing, because Jim Acosta to me is like the biggest douchebag in media. But anyway, let's.
Oh yeah, but sometimes you gotta, just like sometimes you gotta show, like, you know, the Project Veritas thing showed that ABC journalist who was saying she couldn't report on Epstein stuff. Remember that?
Right.
We played this on the show. sometimes you got to do that. Like, they're people you really don't like. But anyway, so yeah. This is not Matt endorsing Jim Acosta.
No, it is not.
It's like we weren't.
You might be feeling all filled up after Thanksgiving, but unfortunately, we got an extra helping of turkey from Colorado Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert.
But unfortunately, we got an extra helping of turkey from,
stupid.
God, just.
She's a turkey. Also, I think you're kind of underselling it. I don't know if I'd call her a turkey.
Yeah, she's not. It's not a turkey thing. Go back and do five more years of anchoring at a small regional market, Binghamton or something like that.
Yeah.
You'll get, the jokes will be better.
Right.
You know, they must not have a good, I'm sorry, I have a headache, so I'm angry about this, but
no, it's good.
Come on. Outrage. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to do jokes on CNN, go ahead.
Good. You're turkey.
Tree and comments about Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar.
I look to my left, and there she is, Ilhan Omar.
Oops.
And I said, well, she doesn't have a backpack. We should be fine. So we only had one floor to go, and I was like, do I say it or not? I looked over, and I said, oh, look, the Jihad Squad decided to show up for work today. Staffers on Twitter that talk for her. She's not tough in person.
We should note, Congresswoman Omar says Boebert is lying about that run-in. Omar tweeted, this whole story is made up. And Boebert has since offered something of an apology to the Muslim community, but not to Omar. By the way, that wasn't the only hateful thing Boebert said in that speech. She also took a homophobic swipe at Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, who is now the father of twins.
He wasn't even put in charge of the supply chain crisis. No, someone else was tapped for that because Mayor Pete is still at home trying to figure out how to chest feed. Somebody ought to tell him so he could get back
to work.
Sorry,
can we rewind that just for a second? It's a really bad sign when you're on your home turf and you drop a joke like that and there's nervous laughter in the audience.
Yeah.
Right? So listen to the response that Buddha just showed.
He wasn't even put in charge of the supply chain crisis. No, someone else was tapped for that because Mayor Pete is still at home trying to figure out how to chest feed. Somebody ought to tell him so he could get back.
There's like groaning in there, right?
Yeah, I know. And this is not like a woke audience.
Yeah, exactly. Like you can't get laughs out of that audience with whatever you're going for there.
Yeah.
And also fucking why? I don't know. Anyway, so she does this. Then, of course, everybody wigs out and she tries to apologize. So she doesn't a phone call. So she doesn't have to do any in public.
Right.
Of course, it's unsatisfactory. Right. Because she manages to be more offensive in the phone call somehow. Right. When that doesn't work out, when that olive branch that she extended, which I'm sure right. was not terribly olive-y. She comes up with this public statement.
Hey everyone, this is Lauren with a quick update on a phone call I had today with squad member Ilhan Omar. I had reached out to her Friday, and 3 days later I was able to connect with her on the phone because I wanted to let her know directly that I had reflected on my previous remarks. Now, as a strong Christian woman who values faith deeply, I never want anything I say to offend someone's religion. So I told her
that.
Can
you stop here for a second? I never want anyone to think that I've offended someone's religion. You just got up in a public forum and basically said that anybody who's Muslim is a terror threat.
Suicide bomber, yeah.
What the fuck is wrong with you? Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And the Jihad Squad, yeah.
Yeah.
She said that she still wanted a public apology because what I had done wasn't good enough.
Apology.
So I reiterated to her what I had just said. She kept asking for a public apology. So I told Ilhan Omar that she should make a public apology to the American people for her anti-American, anti-Semitic, anti-police rhetoric. She continued to press and I continued to press back. And then Representative Omar hung up on me. Rejecting an apology and hanging up on someone is part of cancel culture 101 and a pillar of the Democrat Party. Make no mistake, I will continue to fearlessly put America first, never sympathizing with terrorists. Unfortunately,
Ilhan
can't say the same thing, and our country is worse off for it.
Ugh. So her apology is, first of all, I'm sure
it's a triple down.
But it also, yeah, it's a triple down, but also her apology included a demand for an apology for things that weren't even actual things. And then, I mean, what a, talk about a triggered snowflake. She's a triggered snowflake. That's what Boebert is.
Is this really the best the Republican Party can do? Like, it used to be that members of Congress were
made jokes like this behind closed doors.
No, they were like third rate country lawyers. You know what I mean? A bunch of real estate developers or whoever the three wealthiest farmers in the region would get together and they'd say, this guy is just barely literate enough to do whatever we say and won't embarrass us on the floor of the house. Right. And so they'll give that person a bunch of money, and usually in 9 out of 10, or me, I guess it's more like 8 out of 10 cases, the districts are not contested. So the person never really has to campaign. And so, yeah, you got a lot of half smart people sitting in Congress, right? But you never had, I mean, it was never necessary to send absolute dimwits to the Hill. Like, that wasn't a prerequisite. They weren't actually actively looking for people who can barely write their name on the ground with a stick, right? Like,
right.
With this new branch of kind of the Republican Party, because we often in this show kind of long for the old days when the Republicans were kind of more overtly, like the Bush era Republicans were more identifiable instantly as villains than.
Right.
But this is just being a stupid bigot and being proud of it. That's all this is.
And right? Then, like, just don't apologize. Just, like, go big or go home. I mean, you're an idiot no matter what. But it's just, like, complaining. It is ironic because she's such a little offended. Like, grow up, man up, woman up, whatever it is. Like,
you can't take it
that someone's not accepting your non-apology.
I guess it's Trumpian, except Trump would never do this. First of all, the joke would be funnier.
Trump would make a funny joke, and he'd never apologize.
He would never apologize. He would immediately lean into whatever the unfair criticism, or he would lean into whatever the outrage was, and make it worse.
Yeah.
But usually consciously, you know, or at least half consciously.
And like he'd be like. Remember, he was like, let's be clear, like, Ilhan Omar's apology was lame. It was lame. he said that once.
Did he?
Yeah. He was lame.
Ugh. I just, like, why? Why is this necessary?
I guess because, like, that's what she traffics in. And, you know, if you're not delivering, it's part of their culture war, right?
Why does it have to be part of, like, I'm wrapped up in this Loudoun County story now. These are the people who got Glenn Youngkin elected, right? That story was about actual issues. I mean, you can have different opinions about them, but it was people saying, well, we don't think the role of teachers should be this or that, right? Like, they won on the merits of the issue. And why is that not enough? Why do you have to have a moron like this person? I just don't understand that. And who donates money to a person like that?
I'm like surprised that you're surprised.
Am I surprised? Look, I mean, I grew up in the Strom Thurmond era where I guess the Strom Thurmond era extends for pretty far back in time. So I grew up at the end of the Strom Thurmond era where, you know, you had things like the White Hands ad, right? Where the whole idea was to signal to white voters that minorities are taking your jobs or whatever it is.
Right.
You know, it's the whole South Park, you know, they took our jobs joke. The trope for years was, this is a dog whistling thing. Like, minorities are coming for your jobs. Like, people are coming over the borders. They're getting free stuff, whatever it is. They dog whistled.
Yeah.
And they often said offensive things, but you didn't. just being a raving idiot like this person was just not necessary. I just can't believe a person like that gets elected. I don't know. Which brings us to the next element of this, which is Ilhan Omar getting a voicemail.
Oh yeah.
Let's listen to what happened next. This is Ilhan Omar explaining that she got a voicemail.
I'm going to play you a voicemail that we received hours after I got off the phone with Representative Boebert after she posted her video.
We see you, Muslim son nigger bitch. We know what you're up to. You're all about taking over the country. Don't worry, there's plenty that will love the opportunity to take you off the face of this fucking earth. Come get it, bitch, you fucking Muslim piece of shit, you jihadist. We know what you are. You're a fucking traitor. You will not live much longer, bitch. I can almost guarantee you that. We the people are rising up, and you will be tried for a military tribunal, and you will be found guilty.
Look, normally, I would say you can't point the finger at a member of Congress when crazy people call up and make threats, because they do it constantly. If you talk to anybody who works in any congressional office, they'll tell you they get that kind of shit all the time, like round the clock. And it doesn't necessarily have to be connected to anything, you know. In this instance,
I think it's totally fair game. Yeah. Like, it's not, you know, this person is obviously, I mean, to be fair, I'm sure, as you were saying, Ilhan gets these things all the time, but it's, that one's pretty over the top. And, you know, it's not outrageous to suggest that this type of stuff inspires people like that. When you see a congressperson making jokes about how someone's a jihadist, has a jihad squad, and, oh, look, she doesn't have a backpack. Thank God.
This country is like, it's dividing up into two camps. You know, they're both almost impossible to, the Democrats, for me, like the story we had before about the vaccine waiver, to me represents everything that's wrong with the Democratic Party. They are at their core cynics, right?
Corporate.
Who basically are indifferent to
human suffering.
Yeah, they'll deal with it on some level if it doesn't like interfere with the core mission, which is making their donors happy, right?
Right.
And then everything else that comes out of their mouths about whatever is just designed to disguise that core mission, right? So whatever they talk about, any other social issues, whenever they're, you know, up in arms about anything, it's difficult to believe or difficult to sympathize with, because you know that at the core,
right,
they're about this other thing. Then you hear this shit where it's like, it's a movement that's designed to try to appeal to the dumbest and worst instincts of the population. You know, I don't know. Is this really all there is? Is it cynics and bigots? Is that really our profile politically? I don't know.
Cynics and bigots. I like it. That's America. Welcome to the American political.
Right. System.
Yeah.
I mean, does it really have to suck that badly?
Matt is getting like hopeful almost.
No, I mean,
like another world. You think another world is possible. See, behind Matt's cynicism is a real optimism for a better way of life.
I'm not actually a cynic. That's the whole point. Because I actually do think that, you know, ultimately, most people are decent people. Even our government, as horrible as it can be, you know, it's always had an element of people who tried to do some the right thing, whether it was behind the scenes, even if they were, they act like jackasses in public, they would get together. I mean, those bills that you see going through Congress, they're incredibly long. They take a ton of work to do. Yes, a lot of them are written by lobbyists, and the fine print of a lot of them is terrible, but a lot of, you know, some of it isn't too, right? Like there's a lot of well-meaning stuff in there that has to get hashed out by people who are serious, and they do work. They do hard work. Like this is one thing I got in trouble with Bernie about this once, because I cracked some joke to him about the laziness of people in the House, because they tend to fly home on, Thursday night and come back on Tuesday morning or whatever it is. And he turned around at me and he's like, these people work hard. Matthew. You know, and he sort of laid down the law and he's like, are you kidding me? Like, just think about the sheer quantity of stuff that we do. And so, yeah, like it frustrates me because I think
he at least like, no, don't get me wrong. They're beholden to corporate interests.
Of course. Yeah. He's like that, but he has pride in the institution and this turned out to be a thing that people criticized him for ultimately, right? Like he had too much faith in the Democratic Party. Yeah. He had too much faith in, but he did really, really believe and he was very emphatic that these people work hard. They're not complete, you know, zeros. It's never completely without hope. At least they thought, right? But this new version of American politics where it's, you know, this looks like a desert in both directions for me. I don't know.
By the way, Wilson, can you drop in some My Country Tis of Thee or something on to for?
Oh, is he going to do that to me?
Yeah. Under part of Matt's thing?
I don't think it was ever this bad before. Have you interviewed members of Congress from the 60s and 70s? They never behave like this. And they behind the scenes, there was like some kind of collegiality and to superficial levels of respect.
Wouldn't it be funny if every time you had a headache, you got like increasingly earnest?
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. I need like a pill. All right. Anyway, what do we have? Let's get off this depressing topic
Let's go. Gobert, come on the show. We'll not really. I mean, it'd be fun to just mock her the whole time.
Anyway. All right. Let's move on to.
Isn't that weird? Yeah. So let's just go to the videotape. We got a story at the New York Post. World's first living robots can now reproduce, scientists say. We thought we knew all the ways life can reproduce, but now scientists have discovered a new one. Say hello to Xenobots 3.0, the world's first self-replicating living robots. In 2020, scientists at UVM and Tufts teamed up to hand-build computer-designed organisms from frog cells. Now they've built xenobots that can gather hundreds of single cells. It's like a Pac-Man thing that they're doing. Compress and assemble them into a quote-unquote baby, and then release xenobot offspring from their Pac-Man-shaped mouths. Living robots that look and move like themselves. We found xenobots that walk, we found xenobots that swim, and now in this study we've found xenobots that replicate. I mean, they don't look like, I was a little disappointed because I thought we were going to see like the types of robots we've seen that are like dogs.
Decepticon or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't honestly even know why they're robots. They're robots. The robots created using the heart and skin stem cells from the African clawed frog were unveiled last year after experiments showed they could move and self-heal. And now they're saying they can self-replicate. This is kind of cool. The organisms can swim out into their dish, find other single cells, and assemble baby xenobots. A few days later, the babies become new xenobots that look and move just like the initial creation. So there's a vibrant single scene among these frog cells.
Yeah, your tone on this is completely wrong. This is not cool. This is horrifying. And it's...
isn't that terrible?
Yeah, and it's foreshadowing for the end of our species.
Really?
So, yeah.
Wow. So it's not even weird at all?
It's weird, but like, you know, we're going to be looking back at this podcast in 50 years when we're in a salt mine waiting for the last of our species to be exterminated by xenobots and maybe we shouldn't have done those experiments.
Right. I think that may be true, but can we show the photo of the Pac-Man thing happening? So first of all, they look like, what kind of cereal do they look like? Cocoa Puffs?
Corn Puffs, maybe?
Corn Puffs, yeah. And then if you scroll down, look at that. I mean, I barely know Pac-Man, but that looks like Pac-Man, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Or you think I'm sanitizing? I'm turning into a game?
No, I think they're playing on your cuteness.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
My cuteness appreciation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's how they get in the door.
That's how they get you. Yeah. That's how they get into the cell and replicate. Yeah.
I ain't falling for that shit. If I saw that thing, I would smash it with a hammer.
You would commit fragicide?
Not only that, I would probably take the scientists out and find a nice quarry to dump their bodies into.
Well, this is weird. So Michael Levin, co-leader of the research, said, this is profound. These cells have the genome of a frog, but freed from becoming tadpoles. They use their collective intelligence, a plasticity, to do something astounding. That's a weird euphemism. Freed from becoming tadpoles.
This guy's going to be eaten by one of his own creations in, I don't know, it's probably already happened.
Right.
Check Twitter.
Have we seen him? Where's Michael Levin now? Guys, Google Michael Levin. You're not going to find a single one. If we knew how to tell collective...
His foot is sticking out of some mechanical mouth right now.
He's a frog.
Down, you know.
He's a frog head. If we knew how to tell collections of cells to do what we wanted them to do, ultimately, that's regenerative medicine. That's the solution to traumatic injury, birth defects, cancer, and aging. All of these different problems are here because we don't know how to predict and control what groups of cells are going to build. Xenobots are a new platform for teaching us.
Yeah, that's the optimist view on all this. The pessimist view on this is...
It's going to be like the RoboCop thing?
Yeah, I was thinking more Terminator. But it won't be cool like Terminator. They won't, you know, get in a car and drive after you. They will find you with, you know, supersonic speed and just, you know, without emotion, just pull your head off. And I don't know, it's going to be ugly, but great scientific work. I'm really impressed by that. So
I like the idea of a single cell, single scene.
That is cute. Yes.
Yeah.
It's cute, but it would be cuter in actual living things.
What's the definition of a robot?
Well, it comes from the word for work. Usually I think it's a machine that we're putting to use to automate a work function. I think it comes from the Czech. There's a similar word in Russian, but I don't know what to do. We'll have to ask some of our readers. Tell us where life ends and robotics begins, because that gets confusing, which I don't like. I like things to be nice and clear.
Yeah.
All right. So for Isn't That Terrible, same newspaper, cannibal sharks, half-eaten zombie shark still hunts for prey in video. I'm making shark-centric content for Katie's sake. I think we owe Wilson.
Well, we need to. Well, I'm glad, because it's an expose.
He's half the shark he used to be, yet still hungry. A scientist has captured gory footage of a shark on the hunt for prey, despite missing a significant chunk of his body. The missing hunk was eaten in an act of shark-on-shark cannibalism, according to the scientist who saw it firsthand. Sharks eat sharks, that is well known, but is super difficult to film and document, said Dr. Mario Librato, 35.
Why? Do they have performance anxiety?
I don't know. The incident unfolded in front of Librato and his team off the coast of Spain after they released an oceanic black-tipped shark back into the sea. Shortly after freeing the creature, a group of fellow predators, including bull sharks, descended on it. The gang of underwater carnivores brutally attacked the black tip, ripping away a massive chunk of its side. Despite missing a large portion of itself, the black tip continued swimming about in front of Librato and his team for 20 minutes. It then died of its injuries.
That's really terrible. That almost makes me shark sympathetic. This may be sharkaganda.
I thought the shark. Oh, okay. So he eventually dies, though?
Yeah, he eventually dies, but he was on the prowl.
It's kind of a misleading headline, yeah.
So cannibal sharks, half-eaten zombie shark, still hunts for prey for 20 minutes in video. That's what they should have said.
Okay.
But still, I mean, it just shows you how vicious these sharks are. Should we see the video? There's video of it. Oh, this is so disgusting. Oh, it's just bleeding and.
Yeah, hate to break it to you, buddy.
But... blame your own.
There is another story that under the heading "More on Sharks," and it says aggressive 6-foot sharks are now living in London's River Thames. And it says sharks are living in the Thames with the river teeming with life 64 years after being declared biologically dead. Taupe, staries, smooth hounds, and spur dogs, which release venom from fins, are using the cleaned up waters as nurseries. They like giving birth in shallow bays and estuaries with young sharks remaining up to 2 years. The important thing is, I really like the idea of sharks in the Thames River.
Really?
Like I think that would add a lot to British culture. Don't you think?
Maybe. So you're saying just to create some, like a little bit more spice, add some more spice to their life?
The Hound of the Baskervilles, or, you know, some Sherlock Holmes story, and, you know, Dr. Moriarty falls off the river and is, you know, immediately set upon by a team of sharks. I just think there's not enough sharks in the British experience.
Yeah, they've been deprived.
Yeah. So I'm all for this.
All right. Why don't you pay for some, you should like pay for some kind of transfer.
Well, I'm not like that sharks. For it. All right. So that was weird. And that was terrible.
That was, yeah, weird and terrible.
So I guess it's not terrible.
I think according to you, they would be reversed.
Yeah, they would be reversed. Yeah. We do this almost every week, though. All right. So that was the four food groups. We're going to talk now to Oliver Stone, who needs no introduction. He's one of the great directors, film directors of our time, who has taken on many of the most controversial subjects of our time.
Great director. You may have seen his JFK feature film. And now he has a documentary, JFK Revisited. Very excited to hear about that.
Absolutely. So let's talk to Oliver Stone.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Thank you so much. We're so thrilled to have you on, and we've been wanting to have you on for so long, so we're so excited. Your film was amazing. Lots of questions about it. I just wanted to ask you...
And for those who don't know, this is JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass, and we're going to get into what's so interesting about it in a moment, but yes.
So yes, your film JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass, which is on Showtime, was excellent, and wanted to know, you had already done... the JFK feature film, which was of course based a lot on history. What, without giving everything away to people who haven't seen it, what to you stands out as the major things that have been revealed since the release of that film?
I knew you'd ask me something like that. You know, it's hard to sum it all up because it's actually a 4-hour film. We cut it to 2 hours purposes of Showtime, but the 4 hours coming.
Are you going to release the four hours?
I was going to say,
No, it will. It may play a few theaters in America, but you know, it's really a platform thing, and it's a it's a lot to digest. In short, I mean, just to answer briefly your question, it goes back after 91. The film was made. It was a dramatization, and it resulted in the Assassination Records Review Board being appointed by Congress, an act of legislation, the JFK Records Act, which is pretty significant from a film.
Yeah.
The board, six academics roughly, existed for, they worked for 4 years from 94 to 98, and they had the power to declassify documents. They were supposed to declassify most everything, I guess, but didn't get there. They got about 60,000 documents, and about, I gather, 20,000 were still not seen by them. And they had some very good technical experts working with them who dissected the details, and that's very important in this deal. So what we do is go back over the whole thing again and review the actual proof, the evidence against Oswald that he did it alone, and we come out showing that all the evidence from day one, the bullets, the rifle, the fingerprints, everything is tainted. Nothing would be holed up in court. It'd be thrown out of court on the basis just of chain of custody. On top of that, there are witnesses that were not interviewed by the Warren Commission. Some were interviewed and their testimony was slightly changed. We found three secretaries. A researcher found in the 1990s, three secretaries who'd seen the whole thing from the fourth floor. And they claimed that they left right away to go downstairs to see what was going on after the bullets hit. They saw no Oswald on those stairs, and it's physically impossible.
Contradicts with Hoover told Johnson at the time.
Yeah, well, Hoover didn't know. I mean, he was just, right. he said that Oswald did it right away, but Oswald could not have gotten from the sixth floor, put the rifle away, stashed all that stuff, gotten out of there with all those boxes and run down those stairs and in far more than a minute. He would have taken longer, more than a minute or two. These girls were downstairs in about 30 seconds to a minute. So they saw no Oswald on the stairs, and the people coming up the stairs didn't see him. So right there, you have to question, was Oswald on the sixth floor? And I don't believe he was, but beside that, you know, the autopsy was a farce. It was done by military guys who didn't want anything. They were put in charge, and you're not supposed to have an autopsy run by the military, you see. So the autopsists had no power to really do what they wanted, but they were incompetent anyway. There was a lot of great people who could have done it around. They were not asked. It was a strange autopsy with doctored photos. Now, the photos we know are doctored because the photographer at the autopsy, the official one, Stringer, was interviewed by the board, and he was shown the pictures that were shown at the official pictures of Kennedy's skull, and he said, those are not taken by me. Those are not the shots I took.
Wow.
Not the film I took. So you have a doctored photo situation, and it shows a big deal, of course. I don't know, Katie, you're too young to remember, but when you see the Zapruder film, you see his head is, he's shot from the front right here, and the back of his head blows out. It's pretty gruesome. And that's a shot from the front. And the Warren Commission was stuck from day one with this idea that he was hit from the rear by three bullets. And it's just physically impossible when you examine all the evidence of not only the Zapruder film, but everything that happened in the autopsy to prove that those three bullets were the ones that killed, that did all this damage. He had to be shot from the other side, from the front as well as the rear. The rear, he could not have been, he could have been shot from another window on another building. It didn't have to be from the sixth floor. Sixth floor was a very difficult shot because there was a tree that was growing right there. All these things that, I mean, they're all details. Like a Sherlock Holmes would break into the case and he'd say, this. That all adds up. It's accumulation of details. And that bothers me because from day one, they never investigated this thing further. In fact, they went out of their way to kill off the investigation.
Right. And then there's like the color of the brain, how long it had been the brain. Formaldehyde. I mean,
It's a fake brain that's there. It's somebody else's brain because it was a hospital where they did autopsies. No, that was somebody else's brain for sure, because the nurses, the people at Parkland, everybody saw the cerebellum dripping from his skull. Been shot there, it was dripping on the floor of the Parkland hospital. And by the time, you know, they got to the, it's a strange story, but frankly, the brain, they weighed this official brain, and the brain weighs as much as a normal person, which is impossible given the circumstances of the dripping brain.
Right.
So
the chunk that we saw, right? I mean, the chunk that you see that Jackie O grabs.
Yeah, she's trying to retrieve the skull pieces she's trying to do something to help him.
Yeah.
She really was shocked, and she reached out on the back of the hood, and that wonderful Secret Service agent, the only one who reacted, by the way, the only one, Clint Hill, ran up on the car and jumped on the car. That was their job.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The Secret Service protection that day was just awful, awful. There was supposed to be motorcycles on both sides of the car. There seems to have been a lapse and the car slows down when it gets, when he gets that first shot, the car almost stops. Why isn't the driver, he's a professional driver, he's trained, you drive when you get shots like that, you speed up. There's dozens of these details. I don't want to go on and on, but it really is depressing that this country, in the matter of the shooting of a president, has gotten the worst kind of investigation, the clumsiest, as if no one wanted to know the truth, which is what we also examined the Warren Commission and the details of how they came up to be. And we find out, of course, that basically running the show of the Warren Commission is Alan Dulles, who was fired as the chief of the CIA by Kennedy as a result of the Bay of Pigs in 61. Dulles was no friend of Kennedy, and he was around the whole scene for all the, after he was fired, he was around the whole scene for a while. He even went to Dallas to sell his book right before the assassination. So it looks, we point a lot of the finger at Dulles as a manager anyway, of the thing. And because of CIA's records, CIA conceals everything. They didn't cooperate really with the ARB. They stonewalled them on every account. And this is a shame. So did the Secret Service, but files just didn't show up. They weren't, no interest in helping them to solve this case. The CIA has always acted like a suspicious defendant from the beginning. And that's why, of course, I pointed fingers at it in 1991. It seems to be that it was organized at a high level. And they used the mob. Yes, they used Jack Ruby, who was a thug who killed the main witness. Because if Oswald had talked, there would have been tremendous problems, confusions, revelations. And the mob was around the Cuban exile community who were anxious to get rid of Castro. And they hated Kennedy. And many of them hated Kennedy because he failed to get Castro, both at the Bay of Pigs and then a year later at the October Missile Crisis, which is a huge deal, by the way. It's much underrated what happened in 62. So the events of 62, I believe, led directly to 63. And he was marked from that point on. Why? Because of Cuba, but also because of Vietnam. He was pulling out, and new records show that. And three, the Soviet Union. That was a big one. That was a big snowball because he was looking for detente. He had a relationship with Khrushchev after the missile crisis. And what did they do? They signed the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which is an amazing event. It's the first time since World War II that the United States and Russia have been able to make an agreement. It's really amazing piece of history. Kennedy, it was a major achievement, he said, of his administration. He got it signed in September of 63, 2 months before he was killed. And in this country, you don't go for peace. When you go for peace, you make enemies. A lot of people in government get fed by this machine, this military-industrial complex. CIA did not want peace with Russia. They wanted to get a bigger and bigger budget. Kennedy was wanting to cut the budget. So you have all these issues. And I think what matters today, I'm going to let you lead to a question. But
yeah, I mean, I'm really curious because obviously when JFK came out, which I thought was a fantastically entertaining, interesting movie at the time, it was one of the last movies that I think gripped the attention of the whole country in a way other than as a piece of entertainment, right? It was a cultural sort of lodestar, right? But you took a significant amount of flack for that movie at the time. There was a lot of criticism, about some fact check details and that sort of thing. You must have had a lot of time between then and now to think about what you might have done differently. And I was really struck by the difference in approach between that film and this one, which seems so much, it seems very much like you went through methodically all the evidence for the official story this time around and focused a lot more on that than on the dramatic story of the conspirators. Could I ask about your thought process and what you were setting out to do?
Yeah, sure. It's simple. I mean, I was a movie maker. Yeah. And you have to make movies. They have to make money. You have to continue in this business. I wanted to make an exciting movie about a very serious subject, a grim subject. Most people wouldn't go to that movie if unless it was they were told it was something exciting about it. So I didn't lie or I didn't change. I didn't fictionalize anything. I dramatized. I condensed with witnesses. I, of course, had to shape the story to give it. But the biggest revelations in that movie were the same that emerged still to this day about the military-industrial complex and the Vietnam War and the Russia détente. He was moving in that direction. Everything that's come out since then points in that direction. More files, more. We declassified May 63, where he tells McNamara, his Secretary of Defense, tells the Army chiefs, we want to get these first 1,000 troops out by 63, and we're going to do the rest by 65. Kennedy and McNamara said very clearly, we are coming out of Vietnam, win or lose. It is their war. Kennedy was not going to go into Cuba. That was very clear, and he probably got killed because of it. He couldn't go into Cuba. He said, why am I going to go into Vietnam, which is 6,000 miles away? Cuba is 90 miles away. It makes no fucking sense.
Which is why you start off the movie with this address by Kennedy talking about not just peace in our time, but peace in all times. Yep. Implying that that's the motive for getting rid of him, is that he had an unacceptable.
Right. Matt, you follow the scene. I mean, when do you ever hear a president anymore talk about peace, just pure peace? I mean, they don't have that conversation.
Right.
It's all about what we have to do about this threat or that threat, and we have to be tough on the Russians, we have to be tough on the Chinese. We live in this perpetual state of aggression and tension. That keeps the fluid going, I guess. You know, in the movie, Donald Sutherland says to Kevin Costner, he says, the organizing principle of society is war, the preparation for war. That's what I'm not quoting directly, but preparation for war is more important than war. And that's what we've been doing. We've been preparing for wars over and over again in redundant machinery, costs, budgets. It doesn't end. Not since Kennedy, and this is a major point, not since President Kennedy in 63 has one American president, think about it, been able to limit and control the military and its budget and the intelligence agencies. You can't go there. Even when Trump, who we agree is a little bit crazy, but when he made threats on the intelligence agencies, right? He was warned, wasn't he? Wasn't it Schirmer who said, you can't.
Schirmer said there are six ways to Sunday.
Yeah,
six ways to Sunday.
Yeah.
That's a terrible situation. Younger people like you are really fucked because he was killed. If he had succeeded, like a Roosevelt succeeded in controlling his government, and Kennedy said clearly to De Gaulle and many other people, he said, I'm not sure I'm in charge of this government.
That was the scary part.
He knew that the CIA was operating off the shelf. The military hated him. And that's a very important thing to study. If you don't know your history about this America, you're going to be very confused about the present day, because we're the result of that. I mean, if Kennedy had succeeded, we'd be in a whole different
world. And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com.
That was great.
It was great. It's too bad we didn't have longer to get into it, because the movie's actually...
We'll get him on again.
Super interesting.
It's really good, yeah. It did make me cry. I wasn't just saying that. It really did.
So, really, where?
When you heard the leaders like responding to his death, and like I said, like Castro being like, "That's bad news." Like it was during an interview with a French reporter about détente, and then he hears that, "That's bad news." And then like Egypt, Nasser was really depressed about it apparently, and they held like all these masses for him, all these nations in mourning, and it really did like create the sense of how. You were scared for Kennedy. Obviously, you are scared for him. If you watch anything, you know he's going to be killed. But like, I got the sense of how vulnerable he was in the midst of all these intelligence agencies, and also how devastating it was for foreign leaders. I mean, I think people really did think something was going to change. And I think that from what this film shows and other scholarship, obviously, like Kennedy was really pulling out of a lot of things and easing tensions in a lot of places. And he was lied to about the Bay of Pigs also ahead of time. There's that scene where you see him. I don't know. It's probably not that moment, but someone describes how when he heard about the Lumumba assassination, he put his head in his hands, and you see a photo of him with his head in his hands. Yeah, it was just like this whole sense of how it didn't have to be the way it was. Like, imagine what would have happened.
Yeah, you know, it's some of it's tough for me because if you watch Stone's movies and then like the next day you read something like The Dark Side of Camelot by Seymour Hersh, you get a totally different picture of who Kennedy is, right? Like Kennedy's getting up in the morning, getting an injection of amphetamines in his ass and running around the Oval Office talking about who we're going to whack today. And that's how we, you know, his whole obsession with Cuba was in like an amphetamine fueled rage. But you know, look, one thing that this movie will do, and when JFK, the movie came out, I remember finding it like fascinating, but also knowing that the incredibly specific depictions of these scenes between people like David Ferry, who is the Joe Pesci character in that movie, and Oswald, who's played by Gary Oldman, would come back to haunt him, right? Because there was no way for it not to be a little bit speculative, right?
Sure, of course, when you're writing dialogue.
Yeah, exactly. And so he had a very specific concept of what it was based on an actual prosecution, but it was, but he had a very specific concept of what had happened. What this movie does, though, is it really emphasizes just the total absurdity of the official story.
Right.
So whether or not you believe who exactly did the thing. Right. Like you'll come away with it fairly convinced that there's no possible way it could have happened the way they said it did.
Right. Yeah.
And this differs significantly from something like the official report on 9/11, which also has inconsistencies in the report. But overall, there aren't serious people who question whether or not Al-Qaeda was behind the hijacking of those planes, and that you know, there's plenty of evidence that tells us roughly what happened.
Yeah,
but here, the basic things like how many people were involved, where the shots were coming from.
Yeah,
why was the film, held for so many years before it was released to the public? Well, because it looks bad for the official report when you look at it.
It undermines it. Yeah, the official story. Yeah. Yeah, and all these people, like the witnesses who weren't, that woman, again, those women who said that they ran down there in like 30 seconds to a minute, and then they said, no, it was actually like a minute or 2 minutes, and then Ford like moves the shot, the something from like the lower neck to the upper back, and then it's at the back, like all these things that you have to at least, like it's at least would be in a court of, like they keep saying in a court of law, like Oswald would not have been found guilty. Like if this were a court case, you could not build, it would not hold up in court, the story.
Right.
There are just too many. But what, something that the film didn't really get into, and maybe the 2 other hours that didn't make it into this cut do get into it, and I hope he does release those 2 other hours, is like what Oswald's role was. Cause he's kind of an intriguing, I mean, not on a personal level, but a historical figure. Like he was a double agent, maybe, or an agent provocateur. He was working with the CIA. He had trained anti-Castro people. Then he was handing out like pro-Castro literature in New Orleans, but was the address that he was giving for those meetings was the same building where there were these major anti-Castro people.
No, I mean, the irony of the whole Oswald story is that he turns out to be like the prototype for these pro CIA movies like The Bourne Supremacy, which is, let's take a screwed up killing machine and, have him do jobs X, Y, and Z on our orders. But, something goes wrong in the machinery and he starts growing a conscience or whatever it is and has to go on the run. Like that's a plot point, but it's an interesting character.
And he said he was a patsy, right? He described himself as that.
Right. And then he's shot by Jack Ruby and it looks like a classic mob hit scenario where everybody kind of swallowed the official explanation. And I don't think there are many Americans who don't have at least some reservations about what happened.
Right.
But it's also the country's getting to a point where there are fewer and fewer people who remember that day.
But it is bipartisan, the belief that that's the official story isn't true.
Yeah, there's people have different theories about who did it. Right. Actually, it's interesting, and you know, the I think Oliver Stone was similar to somebody like another one, or I guess Michael Moore, in that he saw he saw his movie making ability as a way to drive the national conversation in a way that's usually reserved for the news media.
Yeah,
and he did that over and over, whether it was
Salvador,
Platoon, Wall Street, JFK,
Snowden later on,
but by then they'd already kind of
marginalized him.
I guess the point I was trying to make, though, is that kind of person, I don't think they're particularly welcome anymore.
Oh, you're saying there was a time when they were in Hollywood, but they also get, I mean, Michael Moore got booed right at the Academy Awards for talking about they're welcome, I guess, to a certain point. There used to be more anti-war movies that by people who weren't like immediately marginalized.
We talked about this with Sirota. Like there was no easier movie to get made in the 1980s than the America getting the pride back through its military awesomeness type movie, you know, against the Russians, and whether it was Red Dawn or, you know, the Rocky movies or Rambo or whatever. You know, even now, as political as a lot of the movies that are coming out of Hollywood are, the whole idea of the iconoclastic director who decides to take on a controversial subject and drive the news cycle for a while, like, who is that person these days? We've seen what happens at the, you know, at the end with of careers of people like, you know, like Oliver Stone and Michael Moore. They get kind of pushed to the edge despite making bankable movies that make money over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Eventually they fall afoul of the system and they end up having to scramble to do smaller projects. And that's kind of infuriating to me.
Not surprising though, right?
No, it's not. It's not
disturbing. Yeah. I was trying to get a sense from him, like how much, like if he thought he was out of the club, then he's really out of the club now. Like how much the marginalizing of him after JFK compared to what happened after Russiagate.
You know what's so amazing about that was that do you remember when Gorbachev came to America? Okay, it was a big deal. Gorbachev was a international sensation. So he came over here. There was a little bit of tension at the time because of Nicaragua. He did an interview with Tom Brokaw, and there was never any sense of, well, you shouldn't interview Gorbachev. Like, that would be unpatriotic. It was news, right?
Right.
It was
a relevant world leader, right?
Right. Don't we want to know? Like, and there was no question at all that this was an interview that we wanted to get. It was the same thing when Mike Wallace interviewed the Ayatollah. Like, that was a great get at the time. When Oliver Stone interviewed Putin, he came back to like a sea of articles that were just amazing. Like, I think the worst actually came from Rolling Stone. I'm going to go look for it. Hang on a minute. Yeah, the 10 most what the fuck revelations we learned from Oliver Stone's Putin interviews, from denying any involvement with U.S. election hacking to Putin's love of judo and Stalin, our takeaways from these truly baffling conversations. Like, you know, as if it's baffling that you would want to interview this person. Am I nuts? Or is that crazy?
No, it's not nuts. And it's like the state that it's not nuts, but it's now. It's
de rigueur, I guess.
Yeah, it is. And it's like, it should be shocking, but it isn't shocking. No. It's disturbing. It's just now predictable.
In summation, I highly recommend that people watch the movie if you don't have Showtime. Most of you do have Showtime, probably.
No,
if you have a basic cable package.
What if they don't have Showtime? What should they do?
If you don't have Showtime, you can go through and get a Showtime subscription on through like Amazon Prime or something like that.
Okay.
But I highly recommend watching it. You'll probably come away with it just thinking there's no way it could have happened that way. You know, the official explanation of so many shots fired within so many seconds, and one of the bullets traveling all this way, and like all that stuff, you'll be like, no, forget it, right? And we had some of that after JFK, the original movie, but it's really enhanced when you look at the documents on all this. And he interviews some of the people who are, whose names are listed as part of the chains of custody and some of these things. You could see there are certain pieces of evidence that would have been thrown out in court. Well, as you say, if this had ever had to go to a trial, it raises some fundamental questions about the propensity of officialdom to lie about the most important things.
Yeah.
This was the biggest story in the world for a long time. They convened whole bodies whose entire purpose was to obfuscate more troubling reality.
And Dulles was on the Warren Commission?
Right. Well, yeah. He had influence over it. It's that part is crazy.
He's so disgusting, him and his brother, huh? But let's say you were threatened with a single bullet while in a car, and you had to say who did it. What would you say?
I think we still must be missing parts of the story because it's such an extreme step. What could possibly be worth killing the president over and not just waiting a few more years, you know, for somebody who might have a different policy? I struggle with that. Vietnam was in the table, but again, that's not a world I know enough about to really speculate. But it's abundantly clear. Here's what I'll say: it's abundantly clear from films like this that they don't have any problem dumping fake news into the public.
Yeah, of course.
And we've seen this over and over again. I mean, there was an amazing story in the 80s where it was leaked to both the New York Times and to the Washington Post that Gaddafi was planning on a series of terrorist attacks because he was so worried about, I think it was internal opposition. And it turned out to be totally concocted by our own intelligence agencies that we had cooked that up. John Poindexter was involved in the whole thing. They were anxious to go forward with more aggressive measures against Libya at the time. And it was just a small story that got picked up kind of by accident by Bob Woodward. How many of those are there out there? Like, is it a daily thing? Once a month? Are they doing that? Like, you start to wonder after a while. What about you, Katie? Who do you say?
Me? I'm pretty convinced by Stone's argument.
That it was the CIA itself?
Yeah.
Not like Cubans on behalf of the CIA?
No, maybe. Yes, it could be that too. I was going to say Cubans combined with because anti-Castro people are a very determined people. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Cuban people who love Castro are determined in a different way that usually doesn't involve like bombing airplanes. That guy, what's his name? We should do a show on him. Luis Posada Carriles.
Wow. That was quite a pronunciation.
Yeah.
Can you say that again?
Luis Posada Carriles. I'm not actually good at rolling my double R. I can't really.
Can you just say that periodically throughout
Luis
the show?
Luis Posada Carriles. Yeah, sure. Luis Posada Carriles. Yeah.
When we get to a slow spot now, from now on, I'm just right. If I go like that, can you do it?
Yeah, I'll do it. Sure.
So if I go, it's
Luis Posada Carriles.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think that'll work going forward.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, stop listening to Pod Save America.
Oh my God. Stop listening to the Lincoln Project.
And to that the Lincoln is, Project.
I mean, seriously, guys.
You're fucking with our mojo.
Yeah. We're doing well. We're on the up. I mean, Oliver Stone's going to help take us to the finish line. You got to, whatever you do, you got to rate and review this. You got to listen, share it. Guys, special announcement. Friend of show, Stephen Donziger. We've had him on the show. He is in prison. And there's a friends of show, Marianne Williamson and Crystal Ball. They've also been on the show. Plus Brianna Joy Gray. Crystal, Marianne, Brianna, and I are joining forces to do a special stream that's going to be a awareness raising stream for Stephen Donziger, who is in prison for basically successfully suing Chevron for poisoning the water of Ecuador and poisoning the indigenous people who live there. They've suffered from birth defects and cancer. And so that is on Wednesday. It's on the Katie Halper Show YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's youtube.com/The Katie Halper Show. Wednesday, December 8th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Guests include Chris Hedges, Richard Wolf, Lucy Lawless, who's Xena, Warrior Princess, friends of show David Sirota, and many more people. But you're just going to want to check that out. It's going to be really important. We're going to have some video of Roger Waters also. So make sure you check that out.
See y'all later next week.
Thank you guys all so very much. This is great. So why do we have ads? You may have heard that we have ads. Now, if you're paying Substack members, you get to skip those. You don't have them. You listen to ad-free shows. But why do we have ads? Matt, tell them.
One of the things that we're doing with the show is that we're donating a substantial amount of the proceeds of Useful Idiots to the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press. Been in negotiations with them for a little bit, and we gave our first donation of $10,000 a couple of weeks ago. We're going to do this probably every month. There's going to be, depending on how much revenue we make. Right. And the idea behind this is to help support particularly their programs for legal support for independent journalists. So these are people who do stories. They might be local journalists. They might be independents and podcasters. If they get into legal trouble, you can call the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press. And they have an amazing array of really useful tools. They can give you legal advice like right away. They will put you in touch with a lawyer if you're in trouble. They may even, be able to fund the entire effort to represent you. And this is in this age when there's so much pressure on independent media and local media coming from big corporate outlets. It's very hard for people to do good reporting and survive because they're not able to defend themselves when they get into a scrape or get accused of something. We're donating money every month to that outfit. That's sort of part of the rationale for why we decided to do ads again.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll keep you updated on the progress of how much we're donating over time. Thanks to your continued support on Useful Idiots and the kind of steady growth of subscribers, we're in a position where we're able to start donating real money to this organization. So thank you, and we'll see you again soon.
Bye, everyone. Hello, thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.